I never want to get to the point where we're thinking that this area is paved in gold and this area is Beirut.
You know who that is, right? It's Kansas City Mayor Sly James. He's speaking at a city council meeting earlier this month, proposing a new fund to spur development on Kansas City's east side.
We have little pockets of nonsense throughout the city, and we have big pockets in other places. But the job is to do this in a way that recognizes that our entire city may, from time to time, need a little help there, a lot of help over here, a lot of help over there. But we should not, in my opinion, set up a system where it only goes one place, because that means that other people who have similar needs aren't being helped, and that's what causes resentment and it causes division in the city. And we should use this to unite the city, not divide it.
The mayor's proposition came soon after the architecture firm BNIM backed out of building a headquarters in the Crossroads using an incentive known as TIF. That's tax increment financing. People had protested the use of this tool for a big project in the Crossroads, arguing that the area no longer struggles with blight. Or nonsense, as Sly James puts it. The mayor's comments get at a conversation that's been rumbling just beneath the surface. The question of what parts of our city, what communities, really benefit from tax financing for development. Are they the places that need it most? Is that even the point? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're exploring the future of TIF. Where will it go from here? Kevin Collison, longtime development reporter, now reporting for KCUR. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gina. Glad to be here.
What do you think of the mayor's comments?
Well, I think the mayor, from everything I know, was caught between a rock and a hard place in the sense that that downtown, while has recovered significantly over the past 10 or 15 years, still has a ways to go before it's truly able to sustain itself on a free market basis. And developers have come in and basically still ask the city for the help of these tax incentives. While at the same time, you know, there is a concern that parts of the city, particularly the east side, have not benefited from the economic redevelopment that's been occurring downtown in quite some time, and that there is some hope of getting more activity there. And also, I think, just some misunderstanding about how these tax incentive programs work, particularly a fear that it takes tax revenues away from the schools and the county and the library and other taxing jurisdictions. And so the mayor, it was a perfect storm that the BNIM project got caught up in between these conflicting currents that are going on, both the need for continuing downtown redevelopment, the need to encourage development on the east side, and the need for people to understand how these tax incentive programs actually work.
Give our listeners a little background. What is the history of TIF in Kansas City? How long has it been around?
Well, I can't really tell you when it was first started, but it's been around for at least the past 20 years, I believe. A lot of people think that many of these programs, tax increment financing, property tax abatements, something called community development funds, in which, you know, developers are allowed to levy an extra sales tax charge to help finance public improvement problems. A lot of this came about after the federal government began backing out of efforts. There used to be called a program called the UDAG program that was back in the 80s called the Urban Development Action Grant. And it was a much more proactive time for the federal government being involved in helping communities redevelop blighted areas. A lot of those programs have disappeared over the past 20 years. And in their place, you have these newer programs that basically the whole premise is you go in and take a piece of property that is in really pretty rough shape.
You being a developer.
A developer. And you make an investment in it. And we will essentially either under TIF allow you to keep some of the future tax revenues that would be created by that investment, or under property tax abatement, we'll freeze the property taxes that it's currently paying and allow you to keep the future value up for a fixed period of time. And so that's really gets back into another fundamental question, in the sense that most of these incentive programs, not all of them, involve future tax revenues that would be created by the project being built. It is not involving actual city cash subsidies. And I think that's where a lot of people get confused.
So it's not, it does not include city funds that exist. It includes potential funds
Right. If you buy a property for $100,000 and you invest $10 million in it, you get to keep at least some of the additional future revenues. That would other, if the taxing value was fully at $10 million, you get to keep at least an increment or a portion of that additional money to help defray the cost of the project.
So how does the city exactly measure what tax, what increase of sort of like tax base comes from that one development and what comes from maybe like a zeitgeist, if you will, of development in that area? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you know, they have people, they have, you know, there are various agencies. There's the Tax Increment Financing Commission, there's the Planned Industrial Expansion Authority, there's the Port Authority, there's the Land Clearance Redevelopment Authority. There's a whole alphabet soup of these development agencies. All of them, as far as vetting these requests from the developers, have an independent consultant come in and take a look at, okay, here's what the market value of that property is. Here's what a developer is going to need to be able to make a profit on that property. Here's what we estimate the tax yield is going to be. Here's how much of that tax yield can go back to the developer to help make that project work for him financially or her. And here's the amount of revenues that will still be available for the city, for the county, for the school district, for the library, and the other folks who benefit from the investment. And also, you know, something that figures into this to a certain degree, and it's an important consideration, is that when you, you know, you improve a blighted building, and if a building's been sitting empty for 20, 30 years, you know, you've got the costs associated with keeping it from being vandalized, from being destroyed by fire, from being broken into, and it also takes away from the value of the properties around it. So in theory, if you invest money, while that developer gets to keep the additional value of that property, or at least a part of it for a while, it also increases the property value of the properties around it. And people will take a look and say, look, downtown Kansas City, for example, had X amount of property value in 2000, and now it's Y. And some of that obviously is associated with these new projects that were built, but others is just the increased value of the other properties around it simply because you're no longer next to a blighted building or an empty building.
It seems like there does, for this to work, have to be a baseline of existing interest among developers in coming to that area. Other, because so much of the initiative is on the developer in this case. Can you talk about that? I mean, because I think a lot of people consider this an incentive to come to an area.
Well, that's a great question, Gina. It oftentimes it's a very reactive process. I mean, the city will say, look, you know, we really want to get our downtown back on our feet, or we really want to get Prospect back, you know, or Independence Avenue or the West Side, areas that have been essentially abandoned for a long time by the free market. They basically, the city has to, you know, either, you know, encourage developers to look at a particular area. And the reason why downtown, I think, has been so popular has been this return that we've been witnessing over the past 10 or 15 years of interest in the urban core, of people wanting to be in that more dynamic, vibrant urban environment. And that's been a motivating fact. But you still have the issue of these buildings that need tremendous amounts of help to be able to be, redeveloped. And so oftentimes the city is reacting to developers say, I'm interested in this building, or I'm interested in this vacant lot, or I'd like to, you know, and the granddaddy of them all was the Power and Light District, which was kind of a totally different animal because that actually does have city cash involved. But the city does identify areas, but oftentimes it has to go out there and recruit developers or react to developers' proposals because simply that's an area. And that gets into the whole idea of how do we get developers interested in the East Side? And there's a lot of other elements, but there are certainly incentives available, but you've got to get that, and you've got to have that nugget of private investment first for the incentives to actually work.
Would you say that the ultimate point of TIF is to benefit the communities in which it's used, or is the end game something bigger or perhaps more tactical and less, I don't know, benevolent than that? I mean, I'd like to believe that the city just wants neighborhoods and communities to thrive, but I also imagine there's a desire to see some return on investment.
Oh, there's certainly a desire to return on investment. You know, and again, what we're trying to do, I do think, you know, there is a strategy here. You know, if you take a look at how cities have performed since the Second World War, I mean, anybody that knows Kansas City from the 1950s and 1960s will tell you it was a far more vibrant place. I mean, I'm talking Kansas City south of the river. You know, you had a lot of shops, you had a lot of businesses, you had a lot more people living there, you had vibrant schools, etc. Well, you know, you had this mass out-migration to the suburbs that went on beginning in the late 60s and really started picking up in the 70s and 80s. And a lot of this real estate got left behind. Well, you know, the city certainly has a vested interest in trying to make maximum use of this great, the great bones that were left behind as many people started moving out to southern Johnson County or eastern Jackson County or the Northland. And they wanted to encourage reinvestment. And that's where these tax incentive programs came from, was to say, hey, look, you know, we want our civic goal here is to revitalize, is to bring vigor and energy back into our central city, our urban core. And it's not just downtown. It's like the whole Midtown, East Side, West Side. I mean, you know, the older parts of the city that were basically, you know, left behind as many people left for the suburbs. And we want to encourage reinvestment. We know that right now, apparently, there's not an adequate return on the investment for the private sector to get involved. So here's our help that we're going to provide you is like, you put some money into this thing. We'll let you keep some of the future taxes to help defray those costs. The greater goal is that, you know, blocks that at one time were blighted, that were certainly issues, you know, as far as just creating a bad image for the city, creating a lot of social service issues for the city, et cetera, are now back in vibrant use.
Could you very briefly kind of encapsulate the situation with BNIM, if you don't mind?
Well, you know, from again, I don't know all the particulars, but I do know BNIM. It was a classic case where, okay, you had this building, a vacant building at the corner, I believe 17th and Baltimore. And I'm not quite sure what the address is. But anyway, it's in the Crossroads, right in the heart of the Crossroads area, a vacant warehouse, not far from the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, not far from the Webster House, which was actually developed by Shirley Helzberg, who was the owner of this vacant building. And BNIM, very dynamic architectural firm here in town, has a great national, international reputation, particularly in the way of sustainable and green-friendly environment design. They, you know, have been committed to being downtown for a long time. When I first came to town, they were located in the first couple of floors of the Power and Light building, the historic building that's now being converted into apartments using tax incentives. And they needed to find a new home. And so they came up with a proposal, like, we've got this great plan to redevelop this old warehouse. And Shirley Helzberg, you know, major local property owner, but a philanthropist who's been incredibly engaged in trying to help redevelop the downtown, particularly in the Crossroads area. And she, you know, said, look, you know, let's do this project. We're going to need to get some tax incentives to help make it work. And they went to the city. And from what I understand, they had an agreement with the Tax Increment Finance Commission, with the various taxing jurisdictions, because that gets into the, you know, who benefits from this thing and who's going to be losing out in the future, at least for the foreseeable future, et cetera, et cetera. They move forward with the project, and then a group of parents with the school district were concerned that this was going to be harmful to the school district, that this money being diverted was being diverted from the schools in, you know, in the future years, because these things last for 23 years, the TIF district does, and basically got a petition drive, which is a rather low threshold these days because it's a percentage of how many people voted in the last mayoral election. And I'm not sure what the exact number is, but it's not a huge number of people to get to sign up for a petition. And they basically got this thing filed. They were going to force an election on this thing. BNIM has a timetable. They need to get into this building. And they basically said, look, we just can't wait for this thing to be voted on by the public. So they basically withdrew the proposal. And now BNIM is looking at alternatives.
So how, I mean, this question of whether we should be using TIF in the Crossroads, which is something that that your recap has not entirely focused on, because there are these other issues at play. But it reminds me of a similar question people were asking at the very start of my journalism career when TIF funds were being allocated for projects on the Plaza. Do you remember that?
Well, the Plaza, that is certainly an area that's been probably more understandably controversial, simply because you look at the Plaza and it's just, you know, this beautiful gem, pedestrian-friendly place that tourists love to come to from all over the Midwest, et cetera. You know, and they have a longstanding, they have, I believe, a community improvement district, which allows a penny of the sales tax. Every time you buy an item at the Plaza, a penny of that goes towards helping pay off garages and other things that people use when they go down there. And you know, it's, this gets a little bit more complicated in that, you know, and again, I, if somebody's listening out there and wants to challenge me, I'll be more than welcome to listen to them. But, you know, the theory is it's a, they call it a conservation TIF in the sense that we know the plaza is a great place. We want to keep it a great place. The plaza is being competed with by, you know, the Leawood Town Center, the Zona Rosa, all these new projects that are going up out in the suburbs, all directly compete for the plaza for shoppers. And essentially they say, we need this extra help to stay relevant and stay competitive.
I think there's what these two things have in common is that there's a perception that these are neighborhoods that are doing great, you know?
Exactly.
And so I'm curious whether this moment is different, like if there's something about the city right now that makes this controversy around the Crossroads different, or if the Crossroads and its pattern of development might lend some kind of nuance to this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, again, that's a great, when is enough? When have you gotten to the point where the free market can come in there and be able to do these projects without getting help? And a big, big occurrence was about 2 years ago, a hotel group, I believe out of Nashville, came in and said, we're going to build a hotel at on Baltimore across from the Kauffman Center, and we're not going to use any incentives. And that raised a lot of eyebrows here in town, saying, oh, okay, these guys from Nashville can come in and build a major hotel project, and they're not going to, and they, every reason that people say they need tax incentive helps was available there. They had to demolish properties to build this. They had to build a parking garage to build this. These are often extraordinary costs that are associated with developing in the city. So that's definitely kind of caused, I think, one of the early, like, whoa, wait a minute, maybe we have gotten to that threshold of being able to develop or invest. But then again, you know, people come in and they make very compelling arguments that, you know, we've got all these extra things that we have to do here to make this project work. So we do need these incentives. So it's a really tough policy question. And one, I think that, you know, the BNIM is certainly another major kind of shot across the bow saying, city, you really need to make a better argument or at least educate the public. You know, why do we think these things are still necessary? How do they work? What are your goals? What's the end game here? And I think
is it to make the project work or to make something within the city work?
Well, make the, you know, the project ultimately is seen as a, you know, the ripple effect, like I mentioned earlier. If you get downtown healthy, you get more people living there, you get more people working there, that ultimately improves the overall tax base of the city. Obviously, you get more reinvestment on the east side. That makes it a heck of a lot better place for people to live. It also provides opportunities for jobs, et cetera. And it hopefully, you know, reduces the need for public safety and other types of things that it end up costing the city.
We'll address how that does and doesn't in reality affect the east side pretty shortly. But for now, I'd like to turn to Jason Swords. He's a real estate guy with Sunflower Development Group in the Crossroads. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
Maybe you can help us focus in on how TIF has worked in the Crossroads. I mean, looking at the Crossroads and how it's become this sort of citywide destination, how big a part do you think TIF has played in that story?
You know, I know there's been a handful of TIFs done in the Crossroads. We've never actually used TIF within the Crossroads to be repaid any of our reimbursable costs. So I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. I'm sorry.
So you have managed to do Crossroads development without TIF?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
We've not used TIF, but we've used other tools that Kevin has mentioned, such as tax abatement through the LCRA and through the PIEA. So it is another form of incentive. It's just not a TIF.
So TIF might not be the primary current source of tax support for the Crossroads, for development in the Crossroads?
No, I wouldn't say it's the primary source. It certainly is a source. TIF is better used for projects that generate more salaries, they create more jobs. If you have a housing project or something else, a tax abatement tool is likely better for that project because you're not creating income, you're not being reimbursed for the expenses that TIF might provide.
Tax abatement, like TIF, I mean, does require sort of proof of a blight designation. You have to prove that the structure that you are redeveloping and possibly even like the block that it's on, that there is some degree of suffering from blight. What do you think would be challenges to bringing further development to this area in the absence of blight designations applying?
Well, there are a bunch of different designations that create blight, social blight, you know, the property itself being blighted, crime, so on and so forth. You know, this kind of goes back to the question, is the crossroads completed? Should there still be incentives applied there? And I can tell you, in my opinion, that I don't believe that the crossroads is done yet. And we've been, our office is downtown and in the crossroads, and we've been there for 8 years. And, you know, there's still 7 or 8 buildings within a 2-block radius of my office that are completely vacant. We've not seen a significant raise in the amount of residential income or commercial income you can generate from properties yet, and we do believe that that's coming, but it hasn't arrived 100% quite yet. So I don't believe that the crossroads is completed as of yet, and it still does. The right projects do deserve incentives.
Could I ask, though, even if it's not completed, even if there's still development that needs to take place in order for this to be like at its sort of maximum level of healthiness mm-hmm. and vitality, is there a point, though, where you'd have to say this is already a desirable and lucrative place to build a business, whether there's an incentive involved or not? Like, even if it's not done, this is a place where a business would reasonably want to go.
And I think that's a case-by-case basis. So I think there's arguments on both sides of that. You could say that a business is moving into the crossroads, but it might be very cost prohibitive for them to do so. Do you want that business to come down there? Can you prove a need for an incentive for that business? You know, then I think it applies. And then there's the other case that, you know, on a separate project, maybe a business or a development doesn't deserve an incentive.
Would you say that the whole city benefits from a healthy, vibrant crossroads district, or that only the individuals and businesses located there really see the return on the city's investments?
I think the whole city benefits greatly.
Not explain.
Just, well, I mean, I think the crossroads is, you know, it's a huge neighborhood. So it goes from I-35 over to 71 Highway, and then from Truman to south of 20th Street. So it's not just one neighborhood. I mean, the East Crossroads is drastically different from the West Crossroads, which includes businesses and buildings over off Southwest Boulevard. So it's a huge neighborhood. So I think the entire city benefits from the crossroads itself doing better.
Kevin Collison, what do you think?
Oh, I couldn't agree more with Jason. And again, you know, the flip side a lot of this is that, okay, what happens if you don't do anything? What are the costs associated with policing and demolishing and maintaining, you know, a whole vacant swath of your downtown area? I mean, psychologically, you come downtown and, you know, you go through, and I include the crossroads as part of what they call greater downtown. You know, there's a definition of greater downtown being everything from the River Market to Crown Center, and I bought into that. And the crossroads is certainly a defined area of that greater downtown. But, you know, for those buildings that are just sitting there empty, you know, there are costs associated with that, with policing and security and fire protection and all these other things. And that is borne by the taxpayers in general. But in the larger sense of, like, what kind of city does Kansas City want to be? Again, having a vibrant crossroads area is certainly a big part of making this a more appealing place, a more competitive place with other cities out there, particularly being attractive to millennials and other young people.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, what about neighborhoods with really obvious, hard-to-ignore kinds of blight, some of which haven't seen tons of development supported by TIF? Plus, your questions and concerns in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today, we're talking about one of the city's better-known incentives for spurring development, TIF, or Tax Increment Financing. Along with its cousin, Tax Abatement, it's been popular in the crossroads for going on a couple of decades now. Controversy over a proposed BNIM headquarters ended up dissuading the firm from pursuing its big plans in the district. Is it time for TIFF to move elsewhere in the city, or is there some other lesson we might be taking from this moment? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. You can also get clarity on how TIFF works from reporter Kevin Collison and real estate professional Jason Swords. 816-235-2888. For now, let's talk with Rodney Knott. He runs a program at Troost Reconciliation Services called Reengage. Good morning, Rodney.
Good morning.
Last time you were a guest on Central Standard, we were asking a big question for the city. That was, when we talk about Troost, are we talking about race? You said that you didn't find the avoidance of certain neighborhoods in the city to be racist necessarily. You asked, and I quote, is it fair to say that someone is racist because they don't want to live in an area that has a large population of abandoned homes, that is in a school system that's not educating the children, that has very few services, economic opportunities? If a person chooses not to live there, is that person racist? It sounds to me like you'd attribute a lot of the struggles we see in some neighborhoods, particularly east of Troost, to economic disinvestment.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I agreed to be on the show, because I think that a lot of times when we talk about redevelopment, we ignore the fact that with redevelopment can come a tremendous opportunity for neighborhoods. I think one of the things that I was listening to, and one of the challenges and one of the issues that I have about TIFF and other programs like that is, as Kevin said, they've become more reactive than proactive. In other words, the city is waiting on developers to come to them with deals to incentivize. The other thing is that the definition of blight has expanded so vast that, heck, any place in Kansas City now could be considered blighted. And I think that's unfortunate. Because I think when the original idea was given, that it was designed to help struggling neighborhoods. And I think that, unfortunately, when something is not monitored, such as these tax incentive programs, they can become corrupted.
What kind of monitoring do you think would help?
Well, I think there needs to be more equity involved. I think that, you know, I'm not opposed to doing projects in Crossroads. I'm not opposed to doing projects in North Kansas City. I'm not opposed to doing projects anywhere in the city. But I think there has to be some equity. I think that if we do a project in the Crossroads, then the next project needs to be on the east side, or we don't do anymore.
One of the critiques we have heard about TIFF and how it's been implemented is that not all blighted neighborhoods benefit evenly, that there are places that are much more unlikely to see development without incentives that aren't receiving the funds. And as we've heard, it does require the initiative of a developer to get the process rolling, which might be part of the reason for that. That's something that's perhaps, you know, not up to the city. But what do you think of the critique overall?
Well, I think that it's in fact correct. And I think that you would find there'd be a lot less resistance to TIFFs all over the city if folks felt that they were more equitable. You know, if folks felt like, well, it's not just going to this part of town or that part of town, but it's actually, you know, one of the interesting things that was said earlier is that if Crossroads is developed, that all the city benefits. Okay, that's fine. So why would not the whole city benefit if the east side gets developed? I mean, you can't say, well, this side of town is going to raise the awareness of the city or the cost of living or whatever, and not look at this large swath of real blight and not consider that, well, maybe if we do something here, it will also raise the value of the city and make people want to live in the city.
When you say real blight, can you describe what you're talking about?
I believe when I was the president of Manheim Park Neighborhood Association, we had over 300 vacant houses in our neighborhood. And we're not a big neighborhood. We go from 39th Street to Cleaver Boulevard, Troost to Paseo. That's not a very big neighborhood.
Yeah, 300. And what do you think about the city's recent approach to dealing with that specific problem? I mean, 800 homes set to be torn down.
Well, if we've got 300 in Manheim Park, I can't imagine what some larger neighborhoods have. So if you look at 800 compared to, I think it's like I think we're up to about 10,000 properties in the land bank. And most of these properties have been vacant for double-digit years. I don't think 800 is going to do the job.
Manheim Park, I mean, that's, you were head of that neighborhood association for a while. Where else would you say, I mean, where else do you work? Where, when we talk about working on the east side, for example, that is such a blanket statement of a huge geographic area. What communities do you work in?
Well, I actually, my office is on 3101 Truce, and basically I work all over the metro. The men that come to me come from all over the city. So I don't really have a specific neighborhood that I work with because the problems that I deal with are universal. And they're not just germane to Kansas City. These are problems that all the major urban areas of the United States are dealing with. And it's basically, and one of the things that I think is important is that, you know, you talk about developers not wanting to come to the east side. I get that. Okay. I get that. We have got to do a better job policing ourselves. You know, we've got to do a better job of improving the school system. We've got to do a better job of reducing crime. We've got to do a better job of dealing with all these social issues. And so, you know, I get that. But at the same time, instead of looking for a handout, we need to be looking for a hand up.
It's so I mean, we could probably or definitely have a whole other conversation about how to begin the process of development specifically on the east side. But I'm curious from you whether there is already any effort going on that you think people don't know about development efforts currently underway in the areas where you work.
Well, absolutely. We have been working a number of years with on some successful projects, beginning with the Bancroft School. We began with the Bancroft School, and we began working with Dalmark and Straub Construction. And it went so successful that we have continued to work with Straub Construction on a number of projects on the east side, Oak Point, and some similar projects like that. We began working with Merritt Construction on the Morningside Community Center. And we're just currently now in talks with the Arnold Development Group for the Second and Delaware project, which is really going to be a groundbreaking project at the first intersection of Kansas City, which is Second and Delaware. So we're working all over the city. And again, what I think we miss when we talk about these tax incentives is that if all we're doing is redoing buildings, then all we're doing is building monuments to our vanity. These projects have an opportunity to change people's lives. And if we don't look at changing people's lives, then we're wasting our time.
Well, I'm curious, if the city were to be really focused on investing more in Manheim Park or other neighborhoods east of Troost, what form would you want to see that investment take? Would it be TIF or would it be something else?
Well, I think you can use those types of things, but what troubles me is that we've got to the reason that the projects that I mentioned earlier work is because from the developer on down, there was a commitment to provide equal opportunity, to provide opportunity for folks on the east. Because, see, if all we do is go over and rebuild buildings on the east side and we don't give people jobs, we don't give them opportunities, then we're wasting our time. Because what's going to eventually happen is it's going to turn into blight again.
But then, so Kevin Collison, I want to get your input on this because one of the primary ideas behind TIF, as I understand it from your explanation and others, is that investing in businesses is also investing in jobs, investing in some of these larger things.
Well, obviously, you know, when you've got revitalized commercial districts where you have grocery stores, various shops, et cetera, they, you know, certainly provide services to make the neighborhood more appealing, as well as offer jobs to people who live in the neighborhood, you know. And so it's certainly, again, TIF is just one of the tools in the toolbox of economic development. But it's the one that's certainly been generating a lot of controversy. But the idea is that, again, you know, what you can do to provide a stabler neighborhood. And I agree with Rodney 100% that there are so many other components involved in encouraging sustainable economic development, particularly public safety and good schools. Those are big components. But you know, this goes hand in hand with helping. And I just, you know, while we were chatting, I hope people don't think that the city has not paid any attention. Because if you take a look, I just jotted down a few things that I'm aware of during my years of reporting at the Star. But the 18th and Vine project is a massive redevelopment project that the city has put enormous resources in. And now they're talking about actually another $18 million investment. You've got Ollie Gates, who's done some significant redevelopment, particularly around the area of Truce and Brush Creek. You've got Swope Community Builders, who've done a lot of work out on the Blue Parkway and Brush Creek. You got the Hospital Hill, which is certainly a significant source of investment.
Well, let's hear from some of our callers. I want to hear more from everyone in this room, but we've got some people on the line who have some interesting things to talk about. Let's hear from Imani in Kansas City. Welcome to the show.
My name is Imani. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a native Kansas Cityan, and when I grew up in Kansas City, every neighborhood was like Brookside. It was like a village where you had local entrepreneurs not looking for a job, but actually making jobs. And I really think the entire 3rd District should be turned into an empowerment zone. We know that small businesses employ more people than franchises do. And it looks like if people say they don't want to invest in East of Truth because they may lose money, they're losing money down on power and light, and nobody seems to be upset about that. And I remember when Gateway was down in the West Bottom, they left and never paid the taxes back. So, you know, I that's where the inequity is to me. I would really rather see these incentives be used either with a bond issue so that there's more small business and entrepreneurs able to have their businesses in their own neighborhoods, and rather than have it be developers from the outside trying to promote tourism, we need people that live in Kansas City to be able to have small businesses.
You know, I want to get Kevin Collison, our reporter in the room, to sort of, first of all, just fact check some of this. I mean, what about this idea that local businesses are more effective at providing jobs? And I guess more to the point, are local businesses not receiving as much TIF funding as larger businesses, or is that sort of a misperception, perhaps?
Well, I couldn't disagree. I mean, I agree that 100% that, you know, when you take a look at where jobs are created, it's often with the smaller businesses, more often than larger corporations. You know, getting back to TIF, again, you have to have, you know, one of these businesses need to have a fairly grand vision to really take advantage of the costs associated, because TIF is not a free thing. I mean, you have to go through a lot of hoops at City Hall to be able to get the TIF plan approved. So it's not like something, if I have a barber shop or a car repair shop, I'm not going to go into the city and say, look, I want to get a TIF or a TIF plan established for this, because it's very costly. It doesn't happen often with smaller deals. What you get often with smaller businesses are small business loans through the city and through the Department of Housing and Urban Development. You know, although I think the caller is certainly, you know, there have been situations where the city council has approved a bond with its intention of helping, you know, spur development in certain areas. That was a couple of years ago. They did a bond to encourage some more free market residential development downtown. But, you know, again, TIF is generally something that you have to have a fairly substantial idea and plan to make it worth your while to go through City Hall.
Rodney, would you say that is an obstacle, like the idea that this is the process itself is beyond the means of someone who has, say, a barber shop? Is that an obstacle toward TIF being a major presence on the east side?
Well, I agree with Kevin. I mean, it wasn't designed for mom and pops. It's designed to spur larger developments. So, you know, there are other tools. But one of the difficulties that I have seen is that the city was supposed to streamline its economic development offices. And they haven't done a very good job of that. And I think that causes a lot of the difficulty for developers as well as for people to understand how it works, because it's a messy process, you know.
Yeah, Jason, I mean, as someone whose job it is to kind of draw businesses to a specific place, to sell people on a location, how, like, what are the limits of a person's ability to entice development to an area? I mean, are there specific conditions that you'd think, as a real estate person, this is insurmountable, I can't sell this?
Sure. Excuse me. It all comes down to return on investment, right? So it's all a function of a math equation. You have to determine if you put a certain number of dollars in, you know, what's your return going to be, and do you believe in the product you're going to build, and do you think the people are going to come? So certainly there are some locations in Kansas City that, you know, I personally would not put a development into because I would think that the obstacles are insurmountable today. That might change in 5 to 10 years, but today it might not be something that we would look at.
Let's talk to Kevin in Overland Park. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I just want to make a comment. I generally agree with Rodney. I think if somebody wants to build a manufacturing plant in 39th and Truce and employ 300 people, I think the city should do anything it can to help that organization. The problem is these tax incentives have spread so much. As an example, in Johnson County, where Oak Park Mall received a huge tax incentive to remodel the shopping mall. You think they'd have enough retained earnings from profits over 35 years to do that themselves. Another example, Hy-Vee in Leawood, they wanted to remodel the inside of the store, and they went to the city asking for tax incentives.
Let's get Kevin Collison to tell us more about suburban use of these same kinds of processes.
I think Kevin brings up a huge point that often gets overlooked. You know, we focus so much on the city and the use of tax incentive programs in the city, where it is, and again, the whole original concept of incentives was to try to encourage investment to return to the city, which had essentially been, you know, gutted by the flight to the suburbs. And now you've got, you know, suburbs like Southern Johnson County, Overland Park, Olathe, et cetera, using these incentive programs that, again, were intended to reduce blight, to help subsidize shopping centers in areas that you've got demographics that most people would drool over.
Central Standard's got to take one last break this morning. We still have just a little time for calls about the use of TIF, or tax increment financing, in Kansas City and the greater Kansas City area. Where should we TIF next? Hurry up and call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. TIF, or tax increment financing, is at the heart of today's show. We're talking with KCUR's Kevin Collison, KCUR-based real estate professional Jason Swords, and Rodney Knott of Truist Reconciliation Services and their program Reengage. I want to follow up just briefly, very briefly, on what we were talking about right before the break, that is the use of tax financing for suburban projects and how that potentially creates competition with Kansas City. Though, you know, there's nothing Kansas City, Missouri can really do to monitor or change what is happening in another city.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it really has, you know, created an artificial level of competition with the city that the city unfortunately then has to respond to. You know, and as we were discussing a little bit during the break, you know, it raises, you know, in the suburban areas, the economics are very different from the city, and it gets back to the plaza too. Okay, you've got these fancy, beautiful, pedestrian-oriented shopping centers being incented in Overland Park and other parts of the city.
Jason, you had something to chime in on there.
Oh, I was just saying that, you know, the economics, because the income levels are different. So if you have a commercial property in Leawood versus one downtown, the income that you can charge per square foot is drastically higher in Leawood, to where that makes a project downtown or in another district harder to do. It just makes it harder to get a return on investment.
Let's hear from David in the West Plaza. Hi, David.
Hey, it's great to hear Kevin Collison back on the radio again. But, hey, I think that you guys were discussing earlier, too, you know, we need to look at the trade-offs. If we don't spend money for one thing, then we have to spend money on something else, you know, like leaving parts of the city go undeveloped. When we have to spend more police and then more crime and all that. So I think it's great that we need to look at the trade-offs, and you guys are bringing that up. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, David, could you just tell me what trade-offs you are talking about specifically?
Well, the same thing, too. You know, if we don't educate our kids, then we build more prisons. And I think that's a waste of my tax dollars to keep somebody in prison for $62,000 a year, you know, instead of making them a viable part of my community, you know, where they can pay taxes and have a job that's meaningful to them, you know, stuff like that. So there's just trade-offs, you know.
Yeah.
The way we spend our tax money, you know. But also, too, when we go to develop parts of the city, let's really try to spend effectual dollars and not, you know, waste money like we've done before, you know.
Well, thanks like, for that.
The green zone didn't turn out quite like we hoped it would have, you know. So, yeah. Okay, I'll get off the air.
Thanks for the call, David. We'll follow up on some of that in a second, but I also want to talk to Brenda. Brenda is calling us from South Kansas City. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, Gina. How are you today?
Good. How about you?
I'm great. My name is Brenda Thomas. I'm the president of Marlboro Community Coalition, and we're in the south side of the 5th District. And I've enjoyed the conversation that the guests have had, but I just want to make one comment, and this is about TIFs versus no TIFs and so forth. We're a neighborhood that has been lacking of investment for many, many years. And so we're also the home of the Target Green area, with lots and lots of money being spent in our area for infrastructure improvements and so forth and so on. We're going to have a big project at 81st and Troost, where that's going to be all done by the water department. And so we're looking at some amenities, walking parks, and all of that. My comment is this. When you have infrastructure improvements in any type of environment, a city, small neighborhood, or whatever, to me, the next thing that should follow is investment in terms of a quality of life. We have no grocery stores. We have no drug stores. We have no immediate cleaners. We're lacking of a lot of things. We have a downtown Marlboro Village that we're trying to restore, and we have a zoning overlay study.
Brenda, I'm sorry to jump in, but we're very limited on time, and I'm wondering, some of those things that you're talking about needing, grocery stores, cleaners, do you think TIF can help solve those problems, or do you think that it is that the tool wouldn't do the job?
Well, I think that the TIF would help. We're talking about perhaps grocery stores, a chain that's incentive. I think a Walgreens, a CVS, all of those types of incentives would help. And we have the space.
Kevin Collison, what are you hearing in these calls?
Well, in what Brenda's referring to, and it gets back to what Rodney was saying, was that oftentimes, again, TIF is a very reactive thing. And I do know that, for example, in some communities I'm familiar with, I used to actually years ago as a reporter in Omaha, and the city would actually go out and designate a redevelopment zone, help acquire the properties, say, if we can get a developer here, here's the incentives we'll allow. But the city is proactive on that front. And I haven't really heard the city say, look, we see this area of opportunity, we're going to help acquire the land, and we're going to make this available, and we're going to guarantee such and such incentives. And that will help a developer have some certainty as to what kind of profitability. Again, the marketplace has to demand it, and Brenda's telling us her neighborhood demands it.
We have a call that I unfortunately don't have time to get to, but asking about blight as it can be used as a loophole for developers. Are you concerned about that aspect of TIF?
Well, again, you know, blight sometimes can get stretched to things that are, you know, just don't hit the common sense meter. But when you take a look deeper beneath it, there are certainly issues there. And again, as the caller earlier pointed out, you know, when a property is allowed to fester, you know, there's a lot of other costs associated with that as well.
Rodney, before we go, I mean, if you could make one plea in terms of how we talk about these issues, do you think that there is a shift in attitude that could really benefit Kansas City as a whole?
I think the biggest shift that we have to make as a city is that we have to become one city. I think the difficulty is that we are too divided. It's us against them. And anytime you have us against them, there's going to be a line that divides us against them. And so I think the key that we have to do is that we have to become more unified.
Our time is up. Thanks to everyone who participated in this conversation. Rodney Knott of Reengage at Truce Reconciliation Services, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Sunflower Development Group's Jason Swords, thank you.
Thanks.
And reporter Kevin Collison, it's great having you on the show, and welcome to the KCUR team.
I'm thrilled to be here.
You can listen back to anything you heard today at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have the audio there by the end of the day, and you can keep talking at KCURCST on Twitter. Tomorrow, here's some local research on herbal medicine, specifically a plant called Sutherlandia. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next.